Back after the break, and we had Shir on Parashat Noach, we had on Simchat Torah afternoon, but wasn't able to record that one, but we can record this. So Parashat Bereishit we had on Simchat Torah afternoon, So now we're up to Noach. Eile toldot Noach, Noach ish tzadik, tamim haya b'dorotav, et ha'elohim hitalech Noach, the very famous first pasuk, that these are the generations of Noach. Noach was a right, totally righteous man in his generations, and Noach walked with Hashem. And very famously, Rashi tells us that what does it mean? It starts off Eile toldot Noach. These are the generations of Noach, and then it doesn't talk about his generations yet. His generations Vayolid Noach Shlosh Avanim doesn't come to the second pasuk. So Rashi tells us Hove his kirosi pebishvachor. Seeing as Noach's been mentioned, we have to say something to his credit, and also Lamedcha sheikar toldot ehem shel tzadikim masim tovim. That tzadikim, that their children are not important as their good deeds. And we can also turn that on its head and say that also our ancestors are not as important as our own good deeds. Very often people like to rely on their yichus, that's, and their Alter Zeda was shamus to whoever. That doesn't make them into being a pious and righteous person. So anyhow, let's look. We've learnt Rashi, I'm sure, in previous occasions. So let's look at the Kli Yakar today. Yes, to come and help us and save us. You're right that we're calling on the Zechut of Avot, but ultimately, what's going to, you know, what's more valuable than that is our own merits. That's failing anything else, we can, or if we're trying hard, we can then try and rope in Zechut Avot as well. I don't think we can just sit back and say, oh, well, you know, that's, I'm not so from myself, but, oh, do you remember my Alter Zeda? That's not really going to help us. Let's look at the Kli Yakar. Ish tadik tamim haya b'dorotav. Lefishe dor ha-mabul hishchitu hitivu bishlosha minei hashchatot. Now, Chazal tell us, and this appears in Rashi, that the generation of the Mabul, they corrupted their lives in three ways, Shinizkuru b'farasha, which are referred to in the parasha, v'heim avodazara, v'gilui arayot, v'gezel. Those three things, that's it. If we look in the Pesukim, that's the Pasuk tells us, Vatishacheta Aretz Lifnei Ha'elohim, the world became corrupt, and Rashi tells us, Vatishacheta is Lashon Erva Va'avodah Zarah. It's a reference to sexual immorality and to Avodah Zarah, and then the Hamas is a reference to Gezel. So those are the three sins with which the generation of the flood were particularly corrupt. That's al kein hikdim lomar shenoach haya gadol bishloshtam. So it's telling us at the outright that Noach was nothing to do with any of those sorts of things. Ki ish tzadik. Number one, he was a righteous person. Hayne shelo haya gozel mishel achirim. If you're a tzadik, that's because you don't steal from other people. Tamim haya b'dorotav. Secondly, he was pure-hearted. He was pure in behavior, I suppose. He kept well away from sexual immorality. The term tamim suggests that he was born without a foreskin. So he was circumcised, as it were, from the womb. And circumcision is supposed to help us resist sexual temptation. Eta Elohim hitalech Noach, and Noach went with Hashem. Lo pana el Elohim achirim. He didn't turn to other gods. Aval dor hamabul, but the other people in that generation, paratzu gedesh shloshtan, they broke down the walls in all these three areas. So the Kli Yakar is telling us that this pasuk is telling us much more than just the fact that Noach was a righteous person, but it's describing to us in what ways Noach was righteous and how he had avoided the traps that everybody else in the Dor HaMabul had fallen into.
Is that fair, though, the fact that Noach was born with leather foreskins? He had an advantage to other people.
That's...
They can turn around and say, well, why, if I'd been born with leather foreskins, the same, you know, I might have behaved the same way.
Maybe that's interesting observation, but I don't think it's in any event. I don't think, you know, being mahul is a automatic safeguard. It helps, but yeah. it's not cast iron.
Yeah. Where would you even get the idea or the knowledge that he was born with that foreskin from? Where would
the term tamim, that's that's where we come. Whether or not this is a medrash, I don't know. I don't know where the Kli Yakar is quoting it from. But you know, in part, it will be in the realms of drash. In terms of, you know, Chazal have told us they slipped up in three areas. So the Kli Yakar wants to tell us, and Noach was righteous in these three areas. Very, very lovely comment of Rav Moshe Feinstein here in Drash Moshe. Ish tzadik tamim, nireh lomar dekatva Torah hatoar ish. It seems that the Torah first described Moshe Noach as being an ish. Lomar sherak shehu ish bedatu vaheskel, to indicate that only if he's an ish in the way that he thinks and behaves, shayach lomar alav toarim tzadik v'tamim, that it's relevant to describe him then as being a tzadik and a tamim. Aval kshu tzadik tamim k'she'inu ish, if he's a tzadik tamim but he's not an ish, t'hainu shehu b'lo shelo b'dat, meaning he's just not a normal person. Ein l'ta'aro b'ta'arim elu shanakel l'hitpatot, if he hasn't got basic intelligence, he can easily be led astray. So Rav Moshe is saying that the quality of an ish is a precursor to being a tzadik tamim. Now, the way Rav Moshe is saying it seems to be that it's, you know, an ish means a person of, you know, you've got to have some seichel. That you've got to be able to understand how the world operates in order to be able to be a tzaddik tamim, or to be able to understand what's demanded of you. I saw somewhere else, I can't remember where, but this said in a little bit of a different way, but the same idea. It said, that's before you can be a tzaddik, you've got to be an ish. An ish is a mensch. So you've got to be a mensch before you're a tzaddik. If you're not a mensch to other people, so then there's no way that you're going to be a tzaddik. The first qualification is being the ish. It's in a totally different context. Somebody once said to me, you know, it says like about the qualifications for a chazan. So that, you know, the chazan, you know, has to be a Yirei Shamayim, and he has to know Mikra and Mishnah, and he has to understand the Tefillot, etc. But, you know, first he's got to be a chazan as well. He's got to be able to sing a bit. It's not very good that he's got all this piety and knowledge, but if he's not a chazan, he's not a chazan. That's, in any event, I think what Rav Moshe is saying, or developing it, I think that's a very, you know, important idea. That's, you can try and be so frum and everything, you need to be the ish before you're the tzaddik tamim.
Mensch and be worldly, in other words.
I don't know about being worldly. I'm saying a mensch, we all know what a mensch is. A mensch is a person who behaves properly, right? Yeah. Then you can be try and become a tzaddik. Now, there's some people, they so pious about, you know, tiny details, but they've forgotten, you know, basic rules of menschlichkeit to other people. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, the whole world is corrupt. I'm going to destroy the whole world with a flood, and I'm going to save you. I want you to make a tevat atzei gofer, make this ark out of gofer wood. Kinim taaseh tateva. You should make the teva in compartments. V'chafarta otami baitu michutz bakofer. And you should cover it on the inside and the outside with tar. Now, A number of the Mefarshim, the Ramban, the Kli Yakar, they make the observation that we've got Nes B'toch Nes here, really. We've got multiple miracles. The miracle that Noach was saved. There's also a miracle that, you know, how did he get everything into the Teva? The Teva, you know, at the end of the day, we're given its measurements. It's not Shlosh Meot Amot Orech, 300 Amot long by 50 Amot wide. And then another 30 amot tall, but it's not massive. By the time you've got Noach and his family and provisions for a whole year, and you know animals, that's they're not all going to fit in. You know, forget the elephants and the rhinoceri. That's everything else. You wouldn't be able to fit London Zoo into the Teva. So they point out that it's a multifold nace. Something which has sort of been perturbing me a little bit is, bearing that in mind, why are we given, in actual fact, so many details about it? You know, that's once we're working on the assumption that it was never going to be big enough to contain everything, then why do we need to know that it has to be kin in Tarset, I think, that it needs to have compartments? Why do we need to know that it needs to be Shneim Ushlishim Tarseha, that it needs to have multiple stories? Why do we need to know that it's got to be tarred on the inside and the outside? I mean, yeah, okay, so Rashi points out that, you know, the tar is there to stop the water getting in. You know, so, like, either Noach would have worked that out for himself, or he wouldn't have worked it out for himself. I'm guessing if he had the architectural skills to build the Teva, then I'm guessing, you know, and to hammer the planks of wood together, he probably had the skills to realise that it needed the coffer there as well. So I did see in one of the Mefarshim the suggestion that why did it need to have the kinim, why did it need to have these compartments? Because one of the issues was with the Dor HaMabul was it wasn't just the human beings that had corrupted their ways, but it was also the animal kingdom as well. And the Teva was supposed to be a pure environment. It was supposed to wean them off that's a corruption rather than encourage it. So, you know, that's put each species into its own separate compartment. That's, you know, without wishing to be crude, but they say, you know, in prison, that's where there are no women. So, you know, homosexuality is, you know, much greater than it is in the general population, because there's not much alternative. So people turn to that. So in the Teva, they're all cooped up together for 12 months. That's the lions and the pandas are going to mate with each other. Therefore, kinim tarseh tateva, divide everything up into different species. That's the way we're going forward. That was the message, the educational message that Noach was to give to the animal kingdom. And the Teva was a preparation. You know, the 12 months they spent in the Teva was preparation for the future. So that's what one of the ideas. Let's look at Rashi, and then we'll look at an interesting observation of the Malbim. So Rashi tells us, Atse Gofer is this Gofer wood. Kachshimo, that's what it was called. Vlama means, it means there. Why particularly that type of wood? So we might have thought that type of wood is good because it either floats well, or because it's very water resistant, or because it's good if you go over, if you knock into mountains on the way, or whatever it is. That's not the reason. Vlama means there. Alshem Gofrit. Because the gofrit is like sulfur. That's shenigzar alehem lihimachotbo. They were going to, it was a message, a coded message, that the world is going to be destroyed with the hot sulfurous water, and therefore you're going to be saved from that. Kinim, it'll be made into compartments. Madurim lechol behim avachaya. Every species will get its own compartment. Bakofer, zefet blashon arami. That's zefetar. Umatsinu b'Talmud Kufra. The Talmud calls it Kufra. B'Teva Toshel Moshe. In Moshe's Teva, Ayidei Shayu Maim Tashim. The water was just gently lapping at the sides. Daya b'chomem b'bifnim v'zefim b'bachutz. So they put sort of clay on the inside and zefet tar on the outside. V'od k'deishu lo yariach oto tzadik reach rashel zeph. It's also so that Moshe Rabbeinu, even as a baby, shouldn't have to smell the tar. Aval kan mipnei chozek hamayim. Here, because the water was so strong, zafta mibaitu mibachutz, it had to have the zephet on the inside and the outside. But still, we've got lots of details here. Why do we care that it was, you know, several stories high? Three stories. It's interesting. Rav Sadia Gaon says that it wasn't just three stories. Shniim shliim shlishim just means, you know, two, three, etc. stories. It doesn't make sense that it should be, just be three stories. If it's just three stories, then each story is going to be 10 amot. Why do you need to put a squirrel in an area that's 10 amot high? Why do you need to put a tortoise? A tortoise doesn't need 10 amot. So, you know, in some areas for the giraffes it was very tall, and for the smaller animals it was smaller. Let's look at the Malbim though. The Malbim is very fascinating. Asei lecha tefat atzei gofer. Lefi haremez haya b'teva zu dugma el haolam hechadash sheyakum achar hamabul. So this teva was supposed to represent the way the new order of the world after the Mabul. It was as if Noach was being told to build the new world. And to, when he took the animals in, it's not just that you'll come out into a new world, but I'm already taking you into this new world. This is what it's going to be like in the future. V'hu ha'olam she'yashut bo ata al p'nei ha'mayim ha'mashchitim et ha'olam ha'yashan. So the new world, represented by the Teva, was going to float on top of the old world, on top of the water, which was destroying the old world. Sha'chomer v'chelek ha'afuri gavar bo al haruchani v'chelek ha'avriri. What had happened with the old world, the problem with the old world, was that materialism and the chomer, the base nature of people and animals, had become more powerful than the spiritual aspect of the world. Afal haolam hechadash, but with the new world, yibaneh me'atzei gofer hakal al p'nei hamayim, would be built out of, that's the atzei gofer, this was a very light wood, according to the Malbim, that would float on top of the heavy water, mipnei shachelek ha'avriri shebo meruba mechelek ha'afuri hakaved, because the gofer wood has got lots of air pockets in it. Indicates, the first indication is the new world order is going to be that the spiritual dimension is more important than the material physical dimension. That's symbolized by the teva being able to float on top of the water that was eradicating the old world. In terms of it would be able to rise above it, the spiritual, the fact that this wood obviously had a lower density than the water meant that it floated and didn't sink. And therefore, if it's got lower density, it means there's more air there, and therefore it's going to, the notion of spirituality was going to prevail. And that's a similar message that we get later on in the parasha from the rainbow. Why did it have to be made into compartments? Now this is a notion we're going to see in the Netziv, and other commentators also have this at the end of the Sedra as well. But kinim, that's having it divisions and partitions through the teva, the Malbim says, is to indicate that in the new world order, not everybody would be together. The world would be fragmented. That's not in a negative way, but dispersed. That's a better word. The people would be dispersed rather than all together. So kinim suggests there'll be different countries, different continents, different areas, etc. Adshem, now why was that going to be important? Adshem tashkit mishpacha umedina achate darka'a, because if one area becomes corrupt, lo yomadu acherim imena. That so that they wouldn't, that other places wouldn't learn. So fine, you know, in Russia they can be corrupt. That's but you know the rest of the world doesn't need to be affected by that. Whereas prior to the Mabul, Shetaru kulam bimdinachat, apparently everybody lived in the same region. But so therefore that this was a symbol of the subsequent dispersion. He was commanded to that to cover it with tar. Mibaytu michutz bakofer. Vehu zefet or minacher hamakevet hamaim likanes. That's something tar which stops the water penetrating. Vumashal el shmirat hashkacha sheyatzitz milamala mibein hacharakim al yichidei segula shamdu mibnei noach. That just as this teva's got protection, there'll be precious individuals in the future will also be protected by Hashem. Kamo Shem ve'Eve ve'Avraham uvanav shal yadam chafafash kachal olam hechadash lagin alehem ubaytum bechutz. There'll always be people who are protected by divine providence. So therefore, the Malbim is addressing at least some of our concerns by pointing out to us the symbolism of the structure of the, or certain aspects at least of the structure of the teva. Now, I haven't given you the pasuk in front of you, but one of the famous pasukim here is Noach was also told that in pasuk tetzayin, tzohar ta'aseh la'teva, and it's translated here in the art scroll as you shall make a window for the teva. That's Rashi gives us two interpretations. Sohar Yeshomrim Chalon. Some say it's a window. Yeshomrim Even Tova Hamaira Lahem. Others say it was a bright stone that provided an electric lamp. I mean, obviously it wasn't an electric lamp, but I don't know, maybe it was glowworms or something like that. That's I don't know if anybody ever read as a kid James and the Giant Peach. That's in James and the Giant Peach. That's so inside the peach, they had the glowworm to keep it all alight for them. Anyhow, Rav Munk, in his Call of the Torah, makes an observation on what Rashi's said here. Rashi reports two meanings for Tzohar. For some, it means a window, and for others, a precious stone radiating light. The fact that Rashi quotes both opinions implies that he recognized both as valid and complementary. Indeed, when large-scale disaster is imminent, a righteous person such as Noach does not stop at enjoying the light which glows in his home with his family. Instead, he makes a window to look out at the world, to realize what is going on around him, so as to be ready to help as much as he can when the time comes. In terms of thinking about this Tzohar, as an aside, I'll point out that the Radak actually says it's Midrashon Yitzhar, which is the same notion, but Tirosh V'Yitzhar, Yitzhar is oil. So Noach was told to take in oil so that he'd be able to light lamps inside the Teva. Why? Because Chazal tell us that during the period of the Mabul, the sun and the moon and the stars, they weren't shining. So there was no natural light. It was totally dark. That's in any event, we've got this machloket here, whether it was that the Tzohar was so that Noach should have light, or that Noach should be able to see out. And I think this is a very important notion, this idea of Noach being able to see out of the Teva. Think about it, Noach's got into the Teva, it seems like there was only this one window there. It wasn't like, you know, if you go on a cruise ship, if you pay enough, you know, you get a suite with a, pay a bit more, you get a porthole, a bit more, you get a big window, forget what they call the big windows. That's, if you pay more, you get a balcony, you know, that's, you know, on a cruise ship. No, I don't think the Tafel was like that. There was this one window there. So they could have gone inside this capsule, basically, closed the hatch, and not known anything about what was going on for the next 12 months. The purpose of the Tzohar was that Noach and the people with him in the Tafel should see the destruction happening. They should see the bodies going past, the trees sweeping past, you know, which have been uprooted, dead elephants, you know, hurtling through the water, all this sort of thing. So they shouldn't be blind to what was going on to the rest of mankind. They needed to be aware of it for themselves. They needed to be aware of it to engender in them a sensitivity to the rest of mankind. I once said a long time ago, I gave a drosha on this theme. I said, you know, basically Noach was being told he needed a television. That's but you know, it's now, you know, that's if it wasn't for the television, we wouldn't know what's going on in Indonesia. As we wouldn't know about tragedies in other parts of the world. We'd be sitting here in northwest London, oblivious to the suffering of others. That's our only worry would be Brexit. That's whereas, you know, the television is, in a certain sense, it's a Tzohar. It opens our eyes to troubles that are going on in other places in the world. And I think that's an important important Jewish notion. Roland, you look like you were going to say something.
Yeah, it was no medrash about some giant animal that was on the outside.
That's right. It's a Gemara as well. Gemara in, I think, in Zvachim. That's Zvachim of Avodah Zarah. That's right. Yeah. That's the Ra'im. That's right. The Ra'im. Yes. That's they couldn't get the Ra'im into the Teva. So the Ra'im was outside the Teva. That's but hanging on. Then there was a question that's about its nose and blocking up the hole and all that. That's maybe that's. But you're right. That's in the realm of Medrash. That's okay. That's Og hanging on as well. That's right. Okay, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Noach, Kili Yamim Od Shiva Nochim Amtir Al Haaretz, Arba'im Yom Va'arba'im Laila, another 7 days, I'm going to cause it to rain for 40 days, day and night, U'machiti Et Kol HaYakum Asher Asiti Me'al Pnei Adama, and I will eradicate everything that exists, Asher Asiti, that I've made, Me'al Pnei Adama. I think it's significant. It says Asher Asiti. You know, this showing the gravity of the situation, and you know, this wasn't just an angry, you know, God that was angry with the people. This was a God who, I guess, in some way felt responsible for what had happened. That it's not just, you know, it's easy to destroy somebody else's handiwork, but to destroy your own handiwork, you know, is much greater. And I think, you know, we should pick up on from that in the text. You ask any cheder kid, how long did it rain for in the flood? They'll all tell you 40 days and 40 nights. Because if we look in the Pesukim, it was 150 days. That's and nights it rained. But the real powerful rain was the first 40 days and 40 nights. And then it was just regular rain. Another point of interest in this pasuk, being picked up by a number of the mafarshim, is that it's arba'im yom v'arba'im laila. Day is mentioned before night. That's number of mafarshim suggest that prior to Sinai and Matan Torah, the halachic day went from morning to evening. Or started in the morning rather than starting in the night. That even though Vayera Vayvoke Yom Echad, that indicates that the Jewish day starts at night, that's a discussion in Parshat Bereshit, that the halachic day in the times of prior to Matan Torah started in the daytime.
So the others kept Shabbos that way?
Possibly. That actually helps address one of the questions. I'll come back to that momentarily. But because we've got here Arba'im Yom and Arba'im Laila. Starts with day and then night. And why is it starting day? Because Adam HaRishon was created during the day. So he thought that was the beginning of the, and it was the next day that he thought was the beginning of the, was the start of the new halachic day. That was his next day. Yeah, one of the questions with the Avot, I mean, now we're getting into, you know, details about, you know, what Chazal meant. But if, assuming that the Avot kept Shabbat, then one of the questions asked by the Achronim is how could they keep Shabbat? Because Goyshe Shabbat is Chayav Mita. That's, and they weren't yet Jewish. So one of the suggestions is that they they kept Shabbat from either from midnight to midnight or from morning to morning. That was their day. That's, and therefore it wasn't the halachic Shabbat, and therefore they kept Shabbat, but it wasn't halachic Shabbat, so they weren't chav mita.
There's a very funny cartoon all about that on the Yeshiva Boy or something. It makes it, it's really
yes. That's right. Maximalist or minimalist, that's, and did the Avot know that Rav Eliashiv said about crops? Okay. Anyhow, what's the significance of the Arba'im Yom? Look at Rashi. Why 40 days? I mean, 40 days is a number that comes up a lot. 40 days of, 40 days here, 40 days on Har Sinai three times, 40 years in the Midbar. That's, we find in Moshe Rabbeinu's life was divided into three periods of 40 years. Rabbi Akiva, divided into three periods of 40 years, etc. Arba'im Yom Keneged Yitzirat HaVlad. We have a tradition that a fetus doesn't acquire proper halachic status until the first 40 days have passed. Shekilkalu, because mankind corrupted its ways in such a way, lahatriach liyotzram latzur tsurat mamzerim. That's, they bothered HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make him create that mamzerim. And, therefore, that's as a punishment, it rained for them for 40 days as a reminder of the Yitzirat HaVlad. This Rashi is quite interesting, I think, because it's a little bit more complex than it needs to be. Why does not say that, the creation of human life is within takes 40 days to create human life, and therefore that this was total eradication of human life? That would have been and it's not entirely clear to me why Rashi needed to bring in this notion of, that sort of Tzurat Mamzerim. If you look at the Kli Yakar, though, again links this up with the three sins which were prevalent at the time of the Mabul. Arba'im Yom, Keneged She'avdu Avodah Zarah. Right, so corresponding to the fact they worshipped idolatry. Person who believes in idols is as if they've denied the entire Torah, which would be given over a 40-day period. It also corresponds to Znut, a sexual immorality, a result of znut is mamzerim, which develop over 40 days, and also corresponds to gezel, ki gezel misparo arba'im. What's the gematria of gezel? 40. And that's a good gematria, you don't even need to add ones to it. That's, we had on Friday night a few imaginative gematrias. This, you don't even need to add any ones to it. So we've got this picture of total destruction. That, however, Rav Hirsch, in his commentary, he turns this round in a rather more positive way. He says, our sages remind us that this is the same period as that required for the formation of the human fetus, so that this duration of the catastrophe could in itself be taken as showing the destruction to be, in its deeper meaning, the formation of a new future. And that's really important. Rav Hirsch is saying that, again, from the outset, this wasn't wanton destruction, but this was, as we'd say in Hilchot Shabbat, soter amanat livnot. You're destroying with the intention to rebuild. The world is going to be, it's not just being eradicated. There's, you know, 40 days, that's the amount of time it takes, Yetzirat HaVlad, I'm eradicating the world, but there's going to be new creation in the future. Already in the act of destruction, there was a message of creation. It's going to be all right. I think it's very interesting how, you know, Rav Hirsch has put that positive dimension into it. Okay, so they're in the Teva, and eventually they come out of the Teva. We're going to skip over on this occasion the events inside the Teva and the exact nature of what happened and how they came out. But I just want to flag up one question. I might have asked this question previously. That's been bothering me for a number of years with regard to the the dove. Might speak about the dove in some respects on Friday night, so I don't want to give too much away now, but big question. Noach sent the dove out three times. First time, the dove came back empty-beaked. The second time, the dove came back with alezayit, the olive branch. So the first time, Noach realized nothing's happening. The second time, Noach realized, things are sprouting again. And the third time, the dove didn't come back. Right? Why wasn't he worried that the dove had died?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the dove not coming back. Noach took as a sign that the world's dried up, as in everything's all right. But there could have been umpteen reasons why the dove didn't come back.
Could have got lost.
Could have got lost and died.
Yeah.
That's so I haven't got an answer to that question. So I've hunted around. I haven't come across anything. But if anybody thinks of anything or sees anything, then answers on the back of a postcard. In any event, they came out, and Noach offered up sacrifices. That's Rav David Tzvi Hoffman points out that Noach, even though Cain and Hevel had offered up sacrifices, there was a difference. They brought mincha, that's whereas Noach brought an olot. He brought burnt offerings. Noach also built an altar. We're not told that Cain and Hevel built an altar. What's the significance of an altar? It's higher. That's olah is related to, you know, going up. That's so. Why was Noach bringing an olah on a mizbeach? Represented the fact that he was aspiring to more. He knew that you have to try and ascend in this world. Cain and Hevel, they brought their korbanot, their mincha. That was just in recognition. They recognized, they believed in a god, or in God rather. That Noach, it was more than that. Not only did he believe in God, but he also wanted to ascend towards God. In any event, Vayivarech Elohim et Noach ve'et banav, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed Noach and his sons, Vayomer lahem peru revu milu et haaretz. That's be fruitful, multiply, and fill up the land. U'morachem v'chitchem yiyahu kol chayat haaretz, v'al kol af ha-shamayim, v'chol ha-shet yomos ha-adama, v'chol dgei hayam b'yedchem nitanu. You will inspire fear in all the creations of the world. Kol remes asher hu chai, all animals which are alive. Lachem yel ochla will be for you as food. Ki yerek esef natati lachem et kol. I've given you everything which, like yerek esef, like the vegetation. Vegetation was given to Adam HaRishon. That's the first 10 generations were vegetarians. Then after the Mabul, they were allowed to eat meat. So a number of the Mepharshim suggest, well, this is the Chizkuni, see, for example, Natati lachem et kol, I've given you everything, Me'achashe nitzlu b'teva sha'asite, seeing as the animal kingdom was saved in the teva by you, V'al yedchem ba'alahem hatzala, and it's a result of what you did that they are alive. Harahim b'yedchem la'asot lahem ketov b'einichem. So you can use them for, it's a reward. You spent 12 months feeding them. They can feed you now. That's, you know, make sure that that you don't kill them before they've had the chance to reproduce. But as a reward for having sustained the animal kingdom, you are allowed to eat the animal kingdom. So that's what a number of other mafarshim say as well. Let's look at Benno Jacob's comments. We've seen Benno Jacob on a number of occasions. He's quoted quite frequently by Nechama Leibovitz and also by the Hertz Chumash as well. Now, he makes the observation that Nach's sacrifice also causes God to do something else. Namely, he permits man to eat meat. Man is informed of this by God, for it concerns him. It is a covenant introduced by a blessing. The eating of animal meat is permissible, as Noah had made an offering of them. The offering of animals is not derived from the human consumption of meat, but vice versa. Due to man's offering of animals, he may be permitted to eat of them. Following Noah's sacrifice, God declares that he will give him the animals for food as a reward, and this reflects the prophetic idea that God does not need the flesh of bulls. So what Ben and Jacob is saying is that the permission to eat meat came as a result of Noah deciding to bring korbanot from the animals. That's, Noah wasn't told to bring korbanot. That's, he might have wondered why that, you know, he had to bring seven pairs of the kosher animals and only one pair of the non-kosher animals. He worked out that he was going to, you know, offer up korbanot. But it was his decision to offer up korbanot. And as a thank you for giving korbanot to Hashem, mankind was allowed to eat the korban, was allowed to eat meat. Almost possibly as if saying that, Hashem, I don't eat meat. I'm a bit of a vegetarian myself, but you can eat the meat. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need meat. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs our hearts, not our meat. That's korbanot is just a sign of everything else. But in any event, the suggestion here is that the korban is a, the heter to eat meat is a reflection and a consequence of the korban. So we have the rainbow. We all know about the rainbow and the discussions, what's the symbolism of the rainbow, etc. The rainbow was there in any event. The rainbow is a natural phenomena. I think we've touched on some of those themes in previous years. Let's look at an observation that Rav Soloveitchik makes about the rainbow. So, the rainbow shall be in the clouds, and I will see it to remember the everlasting covenant. Although the Torah describes Noah as righteous, God did not establish a covenant with him and his descendants, as he later did with Abraham. That's one of the interesting things. You know, Noah went into the Teva, he was saved. Why isn't he, you know, the New World Order? Noah should be the person that we all talk about. We never talk about being the sons of Noah. It's the other nations of B'nai Noah. We talk of ourselves as being B'nai Israel. Noah's shortcoming was that he did not pray for his contemporaries destined to die in the flood, since he could not perceive the potential for good within them. Now, this is a well-known idea, that the difference between Noah and Abraham and Moshe was Noah was told everybody would die. Okay, so he went and built the Teva, whereas Avraham and Moshe pleaded. Avraham pleaded, you know, if there are 10 people, righteous people in the city, don't destroy it. Moshe said, Mechenina, you know, if you're going to destroy the people, destroy me as well. Whereas Noach just got on with it. So Rav Soloveitchik is suggesting it wasn't that he was disinterested, he just didn't believe they could ever become righteous. Noah did not see the potential within man. Noah's behavior contrasts with Abraham, who interceded on behalf of Sodom. After the flood, Noah was shown the rainbow within the cloud to demonstrate that even though it may appear that certain corrupt souls may have no potential for good, this is untrue. God revealed the rainbow to Noah as an object lesson. Within every dark cloud, there is a possibility of seeing a rainbow full of color. So that is the symbolism of the rainbow. It's a message to Noah. You know what? There was potential, and you could have You could have seen that potential. Just as in the dark cloud, there's also the potential there for beauty. Let's think a little bit about the Migdal Bavel. So the whole world was speaking one language, Udvarim Achadim, and they seemed to be in unison about things. And then, as we know, they travelled and they said, let's make bricks, let's build a city with a tower in the heavens. And we'll make ourselves a reputation, pen our foot up and echol ha'aretz, in case we get spread out. The Netziv, I think we won't go through the Netziv inside, but the Netziv makes the observation, and this was, we also saw in the Malbim, that's, much earlier. Did we see it somewhere else as well? No, but the Netziv makes the observation. What was the problem? What was wrong with Migdal Bavel? So what was wrong with this tower that they were building? And he has this malach where he says what they were trying to do was they were worried that, you know, at the moment everybody's united, we're all together. As we get dispersed, there'll be less centralization. People will become independent. There'll be people with different ideas. People will do things differently to us. So we have to have centralization. So let's build a city and it'll be the capital, and we'll have a tower that's so big that wherever people are, they can see it. And everybody will be able to look at that tower, and that will remind them of their joint mission in the world. That's what they wanted, everybody to be the same. It was the first example, I would say, of communism. Everybody should be the same. Everybody should be doffing their caps to the same ideas. Everybody should be united. There shouldn't be any opportunity for individualism, for fragmentation, anything like that. And in actual fact, that's not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw it as being natural that the world would be dispersed. Not only natural, but good and positive. Different nations and different people would develop in different ways. The way the Malbim said it was that if one part becomes corrupted, other parts won't become corrupted. You can also put it in a more positive way that, you know, that's in, you know, different groups of people will gain skills in different areas, etc. That's, and therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu came. And he confused them all. He made it they wouldn't be able to speak to each other. This would all be a babble of languages, so that they would be dispersed, and so that people would be different.
How after the fuck was this?
That's
a few human beings.
Yes, no, it was. Like, I was thinking a couple of hundred years later. That's. But remember, there was a long time between the flood and Avraham Avinu. You know, several hundred years. I think it was about a 500-year gap there. That's something of that nature, if I recall correctly. That's there were far more people than the eight who came out of the Teva. This also links in with, I've got on the back page here, again, comments of Rav Hirsch right at the beginning of the Sedra. That's where, right at the very beginning of the Sedra, we're introduced to Noach's three sons. We'll just read the opening bit together. Three sons, the ancestors of the new world of human beings, are introduced in tripartition. Yes. If a closer consideration of these names discloses a marked difference in the characteristics of these ancestors of all mankind, that fact can be a source of the greatest hope and comfort to us. Completely different though the various races of man appear, such difference existed even before the flood, and as all three were saved by God, it must lie in the plan of God to bring about the ultimate goal of mankind in spite of all these differences, or perhaps just by all such different nationalities working together and inter-influencing each other just by their different characteristics. A Shem, a Ham, and a Yafet were all saved in the ark. And he goes on to say that Shem represents, if you like, the scientific nature. Ham represents the coarser, more active nature. And Yafet represents the gentle, renaissance, artistic nature. And all these three types of people were brought together in the Teva, and with the intention that the new world would be built out of these three. In terms of, it wasn't just put Noach into the Teva and have everybody descend directly from being clones of Noach, but already at the very outset we see these three different groupings. And in actual fact, this links in with a Netziv that we saw last week in Parashat Bereishit, where he speaks about the four rivers coming out of Aden. That's V'hayal Arba Rashim. And the Netziv says, well, you know, why divide into four? To go to four different parts of the world. Four different parts of the world should get inspiration from Gan Eden, but they would all be different. The plan at the time of creation was not for uniformity in the world, but for diversity in the world. And we see that. We see that at the four rivers coming out of Aden. We see this out of the three people, three sons who went into the Teva with Noach. We see it with the Migdal Bavel at the end of the Sedra and the Dor HaPlaga, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted diversity rather than uniformity. And one could say even, you know, that's the perhaps part of the nature of the rainbow as well. The rainbow has, you know, different colors representing different types of people. So that's some insights into certain aspects in Parashat Noach, and